Probably your phone is more accurate. Questions? So you should have found your exams. There's a webcast with solutions.
What is the definition of unitary from matrix?
So the dagger is the inverse. So for an orthogonal matrix, the transpose is the inverse. And that particular one, it's symmetric. So it's actually then just, if you square it, you're supposed to get one. It's also maybe worth commenting that people made the first problem a lot harder because they brought in time dependence, which was not, there were no T's in the statement of the problem. Handouts. Questions? No questions? So my guess is that you haven't been paying a lot of attention to what we've been doing since you've been concerned about the exam. So let's kind of restart the important results that we've got. So very commonly, potential energy just depends on distance from the origin. And so that should mean that if you take a solution and you kind of rigidly rotate it, it should also be a solution, right? Because it's all symmetric. And that certainly implies that there should be some degeneracy, that is to say, solutions that are the same but different. And kind of no surprise, we've said that symmetry is going to generate degeneracy as usual, because if we have an operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian, then if we have Q operate on psi, it's going to be just as good an eigenfunction as psi was itself. So, kind of the first surprise is that angular momentum turns out to be connected to this symmetry. It generates rotations. And we can also speak of linear momentum generating translation and the Hamiltonian generating time displacements. All of this in a sense that I'm never going to explain. It kind of sounds like this is going to generate an infinite degeneracy, right? Because if I take solution and I rotate it a degree, it's a different function. It should have exactly the same eigenenergy. But in fact, it turns out that there are only a finite number of states are necessary to write any possible state in. That is to say, that we can take a linear combination of 2L plus 1 of these YLMs, and we can represent any possible rotated state. It's kind of a surprising result that just a finite number of states can generate any imaginable rigid rotation of the function. Kind of for notation, the eigenvalue of L squared is an integer times an integer plus 1, and there really should be an h bar squared there, but I think the h bars just kind of get in the way. The angular momentum around the z-axis, the eigenvalue is m, and we usually call these functions ylm, and of course they're just functions of angles, and following the usual rule that it's the subscripts that are important, so we should make them big, we can bring the subscripts up when we talk about this function in that sort of way. The fact that we're using the z-axis is just conventional, right? Because if we have solutions around the x-axis, they're just linear combinations of these guys. So it may seem that z is being specialed out in some particular way, but it's you can use any axis you want. Use of the z-axis is just conventional and matches what we do with spherical coordinates, where we make the z-axis special. So what you should expect from all of this is that the energy should depend on the total angular momentum, L, but the orientation of that angular momentum should have no effect. So we should have a degeneracy, 2L plus 1 different states, as m ranges from plus L to minus L. And we should also have some radial oscillations in addition to these angular oscillations. So we're going to be looking at pictures kind of like this, which describe how the energy depends on L, whereas usually we've just had a ladder of states. Now we can separate out ladders of states based on the corresponding angular momentum. And then just to make things complicated, for really strange historical reasons, letters have been specified to correspond to the number that is L. So L is 0 corresponds to the letter S, L is 1 corresponds to the letter P, 2 corresponds to D, etc. And there are foolish historical reasons for this letter assignment, which is pretty arbitrary by any stretch of the imagination. Okay, so that's kind of the start. If we take a look at this sheet here, these y's have been defined to be orthonormal, so they're going to integrate out to 0 or 1. And do notice that there's a sine theta in there, right? We need solid angle, just like we did for E and M. These YLMs are something like e to the I phi times a function just of the corresponding angle theta. That is to say, they are also products. And you can see that has to be the case because we showed that the angular momentum operator in the z direction is pretty much what you would expect. It's just derivatives with respect to phi, right, corresponding to rotations in that direction. So it has to have an e to the I m phi if it's going to have an eigenvalue that is m. So we found out a couple of values of these YLMs. The Y0 was our friend from E and M, the Legendre polynomials. And you can see it has m equals 0 because there's no phi dependence. And we also showed that sine theta e to the I phi all to the L, obviously that has an m value that is L, and we also showed that it has a L squared eigenvalue that was LL plus 1. So we had two examples to kind of start with. And then we started using the 57 commutation relations, which we used, a pretty small subset of them, but I think it's nice to have a larger set around. So we made these raising and lowering operators, which left L squared unchanged. So kind of the number of nodes wasn't switched when we rotated the coordinate system, but it changed the z component of the angular momentum by one unit. So if we think about this in terms of vectors, what this is doing is leaving the length of the angular momentum vector unchanged, but it's reducing its z component by one. So you have the kind of picture up there. It's pretty easy to show with raising and lowering operators that the expectation value of Lx or the expectation value of Ly is 0. And so this kind of picture doesn't exactly work because it implies that there's a definite value for Lx. So usually people represent this as a superposition of vectors on the surface of a cone so that Lx may be this way, this way, may all be all possible orientations. And so on average, it still is 0. And the same thing for y. So we think about these YLMs as corresponding to a superposition of cases where we have angular momentum on the surface of a cone. And it becomes increasingly complicated to think about that because typically, like the orbits of the planets, are planes that are perpendicular to that angular momentum. So what we're really looking at is physical motions that are a superposition of all of those sorts of orbits. It's the plane perpendicular to L that defines the physical motion, at least in mechanics from a year ago. Okay, so questions on any of that? Well, so I'm not sure complicated is exactly the right word, but kind of figuring out what these things look like. If we have, say, a planetary orbit, and we're looking at a superposition of planetary orbits that have their angular momentum pointed in all possible directions that have the same value of LZ, then you know it's going to be a kind of a complicated superposition. The simple case is going to be where all of the angular momentum is pointed in the Z direction, where M is equal to L. Then we would expect that the physical motion is going to be in the equator. And that corresponds to the fact that the function that you have when M equals L is in fact concentrated where theta is equal to 90 degrees, because that's where sine theta is big. The other cases, you know, just start to look like, well, you can imagine kind of standing waves on the surface of a sphere where I'll probably have you plot some out for homework, but you're going to have blobs that are going this way and that all over the surface of a sphere. And these functions, these YLMs, are not just confined to quantum mechanics. Since a linear combination of these functions can describe any possible variation on the surface of a sphere, I mean, you could describe the temperature every place on the planet as a linear combination of these YLMs. Commonly, the strength of gravity, for example, is expanded in these YLMs, right? You know that G isn't exactly equal to 9.8, it's different spots. And you can express that difference kind of like as a Taylor series expansion, but a Taylor series expansion using these YLMs. It should all sound kind of like the multipole expansion from E and M. Okay. So the plan is kind of like the plan from chapter 2. Let's do some examples in multi-dimensions using this angular momentum stuff. But certainly the principal example is going to be the hydrogen atom, because you can buy them, whereas it's harder to buy infinite square wells. So you can actually do experiments on hydrogen atoms and compare the energy levels to what differential equation says those energy levels have to be. Questions? Okay, so kind of our starting point then is right here, where one of the many things we showed in the day of 57 commutation relations was the momentum operator could be listed as momentum squared, so the I gets squared, so we're kind of expecting a minus sign. It has derivatives with respect to R, and it has the angular momentum operator divided by R squared. And remember that the angular momentum operator, so this is just writing the Laplacian in terms of derivatives with respect to angles, that's all in the L squared, and derivatives with respect to R. So again, it's kind of radial momentum versus angular momentum. So if we think about Schrodinger's equation, right, so P squared over 2m plus a potential that just depends on R, we're looking for h psi equals e psi. Kind of the plan is to use separation of variables just as before. And if we kind of plug and chug our way through this, I guess. So we've got minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives of r plus 2 over r, derivative with respect to r. And then we've got the angular momentum term. So that's going to be plus l squared over 2m r squared, plus the potential, which just depends on r. All of this, we're looking for an eigenfunction of that operator. And because all of the angular stuff is here and all of the radial stuff is elsewhere, we can look to separate this equation into a radial piece and a piece that just depends on angles. And I might as well kind of immediately write that angular piece as a YLM. So if I do that, then the YLM, it's going to go through all of this stuff except when it hits the L squared. When it hits the L squared, it's going to give me an h bar squared LL plus 1 times itself. So I then have YLMs on both sides of the equation, and I can cancel them out. And I then have the radial Schrodinger equation. So minus h bar squared over 2m, this derivative stuff, then h bar squared ll plus 1 over 2m r squared, plus the potential, which I'm assuming just depends on r. I need to satisfy that differential equation. So one of the kind of tricks is to recognize that this quantity acting on R can be rewritten as 1 over R, R times R, second derivative. So, I don't know, let's check that out. So we have 1 over R. The first derivative of this is going to give me an R plus R, R prime. And the second derivative of this is going to give me R prime plus R double prime, which is, of course, going to give us 2 over R, R prime plus R double prime. So what that means is I can call capital R times R another function. I can call that U. And then the radial equation looks Then the radial equation for U looks exactly like a one-dimensional problem. Right? This inclusion of the first derivative disappears with this definition of U as opposed to capital R. So sometimes this is a useful trick. Sometimes it's not a useful trick. This quantity here, I assume back in mechanics, was called the effective potential. And what it means is that it's very hard to reach the origin because you have this centrifugal potential, angular momentum divided by r squared, that gets huge as r goes to zero. So the planets happily don't go visiting the sun. So the standard exit to science fiction movies where the dead body of the hero is gently tossed off the spaceship and they claim it's going to go into the sun, right? It's not, right? It's going to orbit just like the spaceship does. It's going to be repelled by this centrifugal potential, and it has no chance of getting anywhere close to the sun. Okay, so a couple of equivalent formulations of the radial equation, and now it's just a matter of, you know, take your favorite V of R and find solutions to the corresponding equations. The equations are going to give us the eigenenergies, and the eigenenergies we're going to allow to plot up in that sort of way. Okay, sound like a plan? It might be worth reminding you that when we were in one dimension, these matrix elements were things like this. Now that we're in three dimensions, we're going to have dx, dy, dz, which is to say the volume element. And the volume element in three-dimension spherical coordinates is r squared dr d omega. So this sort of matrix element is going to end up being, R complex conjugated R, R squared dr, and then two y's and a d omega. So the y's are going to automatically generate normality if we have a different value of L or a different value of M. And that means that the orthogonality that the other orthogonality we need is the orthogonality of, for example, these two functions, which have the same value of L, but different values of this radial excitation. Okay? And interestingly enough, if we combine an R with each one of those guys, what we're going to get is U star du, right? So again, in terms of U, everything looks pretty much like a one-dimensional problem, which is both good and bad. So I think that it is an unfortunate fact of life that pretty commonly people plot as the wave function U as opposed to capital R, and that can lead to confusions, which maybe we'll talk about in the future. Okay, so about the simplest potential we can have is the square well potential, where the potential is zero every place inside a sphere of radius A, and it's infinite every place outside. So what we have is a boundary condition that psi has to go to zero at R equals A. So let's try and solve that problem. Okay, so if the potential is zero, we have a simple seeming differential equation. We've got minus h bar squared over 2m given by that. Or if we wanted to, we could rewrite this in terms of basically U. And there's yet another not uncommonly used kind of useful way of writing the same quantity, and that is 1 over r derivative with respect to r of r times the derivative with respect to r of r. This wants to be an r squared. So there are kind of three equivalent ways we can formulate the corresponding differential equation. And if you look here, you'll see those three guys starting to look kind of in that general direction. Okay, but first, kind of the first thing we want to do when solving these sorts of problems is go to dimensionless coordinates. So it's pretty obvious that we want to scale our r's to the size of the box, right? So we can make a dimensionless version of r that is just r divided by a. Okay, so what that means is that a times r prime is equal to r. And if we plug that through here, then this is going to be a squared r prime squared. And these r's are also all in the denominator. So these are going to all become r derivatives, but with a 1 over a squared in them. So if we kind of plug and chug our way through this, what we've got is h bar squared over 2m a squared, right? That term there and that term there, those are all common factors, so I can pull those guys out. So then I have derivative with respect to r prime squared. Sometime I'm pretty quickly going to stop using dimensionless coordinates, stop using the primes. So this is all capital R plus L over L plus 1 divided by R squared. Now again and again and again, we have found it useful to rewrite the energy as h bar squared k squared over 2m. And you can see kind of why the h bar squared over 2m, that's all looking good. The k is basically the 2 pi over the wavelength that you're going to have radially. Related, sometimes it's called the wave number, and since h bar k is equal to the momentum, it's easy to kind of figure out what's going on. Okay. Well, we've got kind of an alternative way of formulating all of these variables, right? We've got this h bar squared over 2m as a common factor, and we can also divide everything through by k. That's going to make all of those things kr's. And so we get a differential equation that is just in terms of k times r. Okay, so I'm going to define rho to be k times r prime. And then I get a differential equation that is, there should have been a minus sign there, minus 2 derivatives with respect to rho squared plus 2 over rho derivative with respect to rho plus LL plus 1 divided by rho squared. All of this operating on capital R is equal to just plus 1, because I've divided everything through, plus 1 times R. Okay, so that's kind of the starting point for these equations. We have three different forms that we can use under different circumstances. You notice here I've got plus or minus r. So what I'm thinking about is the possibility that the energy is negative, in which case we would have basically kappas, as it were. But what we're going to do today, we're only going to have a positive energy solution, so there's just a plus one. So the only difference, though, if I have kind of negative kinetic energy, as it were, cases where the energy is less than the potential energy, classically disallowed regions, then I'm going to have just a minus one there. Okay, so you know, now we've got a dimensionless differential equation to solve. We can kind of solve it in the usual sort of way. So first thing is to look at dimensionless coordinates. Go to dimensionless coordinates. The next thing we pretty much always want to do with the differential equation is look at limits. How does this function behave in the case of rho goes to zero and rho goes to infinity? Well, in the limit of rho going to infinity, the centrifugal potential is going to go to zero. And so we just have this derivative stuff wants to equal 1 times the function. And remember that I could have rewritten all of this stuff if I had wanted to as minus two derivatives with respect to u now being equal to plus one times u. And, you know, that's our favorite solution, right? U is going to be sine or cosine of rho. And remember that rho is really k times r, so that's looking pretty familiar territory. And remember also that u is equal to r times r. So what we're saying here is these solutions are going to be like 1 over r sine or cosine of kr. Okay, so first of all, why the 1 over r? Well, if you think about it, in an expanding sphere, as these waves move out, the amplitude has to get smaller, right? Because there's going to be a conservation law. So we need something like that 1 over r to reflect the fact that the wave function is being spread over larger and larger spheres. And the oscillation like sines or cosines is, you know, very familiar. Okay, so frequently we're going to make more use out of this limit as rho goes to infinity than we are today. Mostly we're using it just to see kind of how these functions look. The limit rho goes to zero is typically always an important thing to do that we are going to make direct use out of. So if we think about Taylor series expansions for capital R, then that means that at lowest possible orders, cap R has to go like rho to some power. And we're kind of seeking what that power is that would satisfy the corresponding differential equation. Okay, so plug and chug through this thing. So here we're going to get minus a times a minus 1 times rho to the a minus 2 from taking two derivatives. Here we're going to get 2a rho to the a minus 2. Once one of these losses is due to the derivative, the other loss is due to the rho in the denominator. And then we're going to get plus ll plus 1 rho to the a minus 2. And this thing wants to all equal rho to the a. Okay, so we have the same power of rho on the left-hand side, so let's put all of those pieces together. So here we have a plus a, and here we have a minus 2a. So we can put those guys together to give us that. And here we have an ll plus 1. Now this is not, in some sense, looking good. Let's multiply everything through here by rho to the 2 minus a. That cancels out this. So now we have this, and here we have a rho squared that's left. But in the limit of small rho, rho squared is going to go to zero. So it must be that this quantity is equal to zero. And I don't know, that's a simple equation. It has one obvious root, namely that it's a quadratic equation for A. So it has one obvious root that A is equal to L. It also has a solution that A is equal to minus L plus 1. Obviously, minus L plus 1 is singular. When rho goes to 0, it's going to give you an infinite value, so it's not going to be normalizable in general. So we're going to be interested in the function starting like rho to the L. Now, you know, kind of with prejudice of forethought, obviously, these solutions here have something to do with what we're talking about. These guys here up top, the JL, they're going like Z to the L. They're going to be the good solutions. These things which I'm listing as Y, they go like 1 over Z to the L plus 1. And so they're going to be the singular solutions. The book, for some strange reason, well, not super strange, the names for obscure functions become increasingly less defined, and the book uses an N, which is, I'm going to claim, the less common name for these functions, which are named for the famous dead astronomer Bessel. So incidentally, if we have the classically disallowed region, we should have growing solutions and decaying solutions, and those are the ones that are on the right-hand side. You notice that they don't have nice names the way the J and the L do, the J and the Y do, which is unfortunate, but maybe not as surprising. The oscillating solutions are of way more use. Okay, so step one, go to dimensionless coordinates. Step two, look at the limits where rho is going to extreme values. And three, factor out the previous solution and look for a power law. Now I should say a polynomial. Okay, so I can write any function as a Taylor series expansion. So I'm going to say that R, I'm going to factor out the rho to the L that I know has to be there, but aside from that, it's going to be a polynomial and we need to figure out what the coefficients of that polynomial are. So just a quick comment, one of the reasons we had to go to dimensionless coordinates is so that we would have A of k's that were natural numbers, right, that didn't have units. If those rows had units, those A's would have to have units, and things would certainly look like a mess. Very commonly, we're interested in having this be a terminating polynomial. In this particular case, this thing is actually going to be an infinite polynomial. And that's kind of no surprise, right? Sine and cosine, which we know this thing wants to be when rho goes to infinity, they have non-terminating power sequence, right? So cosine is 1 minus theta squared over 2 factorial plus theta to the 4th over 4 factorial, etc. They have non-terminating, alternating power series expansions. And that's going to turn out to be the same way for these functions, which I might as well name spherical Bessel functions. Okay, so the plan, the hope, is to solve this, to find these coefficients ak with a two-term recursion relation. Okay, so we did this before for the simple harmonic oscillator. The plan is that a0 is going to tell us a1, and a1 is going to tell us the value for a2, and so it goes. So giving a starting point, I can figure out what all of them are. And of course, the starting point just tells you the overall scale of the function. It's arbitrary, right? It has to do with the normalization of the wave function. Okay, well, does it work? Well, obviously, if it didn't work, we wouldn't be going this way. And basically, all of the problems that are solvable are solved pretty much this way. Okay, so what do we got here? So if I take two derivatives of this, I'm going to get ak, and I would have had ak plus l, so I'm going to get 1k plus l coming down, and another k plus l coming down. Same thing applies here, right? I'm going to get 2ak, k plus l, and then this rho so I should have written this then as rho to the k minus 2. And here I'm also going to lose two values. And on the other side, I'm going to have ak rho to the k plus l. I guess all of these have plus l's. Now I've got kind of a mismatch, right? On the right-hand side, I have unlowered powers of rho, whereas on the left-hand side, I have everything being lowered by 2. And what that must mean is that if I jack up k by 2, the coefficient here has to match the coefficient there. So if on the left-hand side I send k to k plus 2, what I'm going to have then is a common factor of k plus 2. And we can do a little bit of factoring here. So we have a common factor of k plus 2 now times l. And here we're going to have k plus 2 from the upshot. And then this minus 1 is going to become plus 1. Because of that 2. And we still have, this was all negative, and then we still have the plus L, L plus 1, and this all has to equal AK. So now we have the same coefficient on the right and left side of the same power of rho, so these two things have to be the same. And they give us then a recursion relation for what the next value of k of ak needs to be. So ak plus 2 has to equal ak times this garbage. And I think I want to factor out the minus sign. And then I've got a k plus 2 plus l k plus 3 plus l minus l, l plus 1. Okay, so if I do that, I can do that to infinity. It's not going to terminate, and I'm going to have a nice alternating power law. It's only going to have even powers of rho, right? Because if I start with A0, I'm going to get A2, not A1, and then A2 is going to give us A4, and up we go. Well, this seems like an unhappy answer, right? So there's the answer. How can we have a slightly better answer to what this function is that solves this differential equation? So I've already named these functions spherical Bessel functions, lowercase j sub l. How would I discover that recursion relationship leads to that particular function, that dead physicist, dead astronomer? And what I want to advertise is what I think is a very useful thing called generalized hypergeometric functions. Generalized hypergeometric functions are probably include every function that you know and zillions that you don't know. So it's a very general sort of way of writing functions. And it can serve as an index. That is to say, you can pretty easily go from a recursion relation like that to what the corresponding hypergeometric function is, and then you can look up the name, the particular name for that hypergeometric function. Okay, so what is a generalized hypergeometric function? Well, let's start with kind of a simple case. F11, it has one parameter up top, it has one parameter down below, and it's a function of x. And it is defined to be that. Now, you may have forgotten what this symbology means. This is so-called Pockhammer symbol or shifted factorial. It's equal to b, it's like a factorial, except instead of starting at 1, it starts at b, and it works its way up for a total of n terms. And that means it's going to end at b plus n minus 1, since it started at 0. Okay, so what's the claim to fame of these hypergeometric functions? Well, what is the ratio of one term to the next term? So if I call this whole term capital A, what's the relationship between a of n plus 1 and an? Well, one term up is going to have one more term for a, right? So it's going to have a plus, the previous one stopped at n minus 1, so the new one is going to stop at n. And same thing here. Right, the factorial is now going to have one more term in it. Okay, so what this means is anytime I have a recursion relation like this, I can just look at what's in the numerator and what's in the denominator, and I can automatically read off what the corresponding A and B components are. Now, this particular case has nothing in the numerator, so it has to have zero terms up top and one term below. Oops, usually use a dash then. It has to be a function like that. We'll soon run into F21s where we have two components up top and one below. So generalized mean you can have any number of components up top and any number below, and you can therefore solve any recursion relation where you have a polynomial in K in the numerator and the denominator. And my point is, and so what this then serves as is an index. You can then see what that generalized hypergeometric is in terms of more familiar names, like at least more familiar names to me and other famous dead physicists like Bessel. Okay, so there you see, remember that our term had an overall factor of rho to the L, and then it had this polynomial. And the polynomial that we have has an index that is L plus 3/2. And knowing that fact, I can convert that into Bessel language. Okay, so if these things are spherical Bessel functions, what are Bessel functions? Well, it's the difference between lowercase and uppercase, and with slight differences. So we have this lowercase j sub L, and notice that there's a capital J sub L, but actually it's L plus 1/2. So those things are the Bessel functions without the word spherical added to them. And it'll turn out that the normal Bessel functions are appropriate typically for cylindrical problems. And these cases where we have an index that is plus a half are usually appropriate to spherical problems, hence spherical Bessel functions versus just normal Bessel functions. Okay, so there are versions of Bessel functions. So you should expect if you have a differential equation, there should be two independent solutions. So here we have the solution that's regular at the origin and irregular at the origin. And here we have ones that are exponentially decaying and exponentially growing. All solutions basically to the same differential equation. So one of the, I don't know if it's a disappointment or not, one of the surprises is that spherical Bessel functions actually have somewhat irregular expressions in terms of sines and cosines. Same thing applies for the y's. Somewhat regular expressions in terms of sines and cosines. So you might wonder why bother with inventing spherical Bessel functions if they're just linear, arbitrary linear combinations of sines and cosines. Well, it gets pretty messy to write them out as linear combinations of sines and cosines. I think that's a sufficient reason. And the normal Bessel functions can't be so written. So it's nice to have a generalized Bessel function, and then it can apply to all of these cases.
Does Mathematica know the spherical Bessel functions?
It does now. So in the past, you actually had to write it in terms of indices that were half integers. But these days, it knows spherical Bessel functions. And I'll probably have you work some problems with this thing. OK, so let's back up for a second. Where were we when we were talking about the square well? So when we had the one-dimensional square well, we found that the solutions were sines and cosines. And then we had to fit a sine or cosine into the box. So we had to adjust the wavelength of sine and cosine so it fit in the box. And now we have to do that same thing for these cases here. Right? They oscillate. So between 0 and A, they oscillate. And I have to make sure that it doesn't end in that sort of disastrous way, that it, in fact, is zero at the edge of the box. So for sines and cosines, it's really easy to know what the zeros are, right? The zeros of sine are multiples of pi. What are the zeros of spherical Bessel functions? Not memorable is the answer. So you can pick out approximately where the zeros of the spherical Bessel functions are. So for the zero case, it looks like it's for the zero case, because it is just a sine, it is going to be just at multiples of pi. But if we look at the L equals 1, you can see, it looks like about 4.5 and maybe, 6 and a little bit. We can pick out those zeros, and now we have to fit fit that Bessel function into the box. So what we're going to have for our solutions is some of these JLs, but what we're going to have here needs to be one of the roots of JL times R divided by A. So that when I put in R is equal to A, I get a zero at the appropriate spot. So we're going to be very interested in the roots of Bessel functions. And they're not typically at obvious spots, but Mathematica knows the roots of all of the Bessel functions. So we can get from Mathematica immediately where those roots are. Okay, so let's back way up further. What we really care about is the energy. What is the energy of this solution? Well, so the energy for the energy for the One-dimensional square well with just the kinetic energy. So here we have a value of K that is equal to that root divided by A. So the corresponding energy is going to be h bar squared over 2m a squared, and then one of those roots squared. Okay. So the radial solutions are spherical Bessel functions. The energies are determined by the roots of the spherical Bessel functions. And then we can go off to the races and do the same sort of problems we did with the one-dimensional box. It might be worth pointing at this equation here, the Hankel functions. All of these dead physicists. I think these Ys are often called Neumann functions. The Hankel functions are things that are designed to look like e to the I z, and they're linear combinations of the j and the y. And they might play a role in the last chapter of this course. Okay. So